Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Rob Laidlaw. He spent more than 35 years working to protect animals of all kinds. His work spans multiple countries, has involved a wide range of successful campaigns and projects, including initiatives to change laws, raise public awareness, litigate in the courts, and rescue animals. Rob is a chartered biologist, founder of the wildlife protection organization ZooCheck, and an award-winning author of 9 children's books about animal welfare and wildlife protection. In 2014, he received the Frederick A. McGrand Award for substantial contributions to animal welfare in Canada. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So maybe we should start. Can we talk a little bit, what is ZooCheck? What's the organization?
ZooCheck is most commonly characterized as a watchdog group on the zoo industry, but our actual activities go far beyond just zoo issues. We deal with other wildlife and captivity issues, so we look at issues pertaining to the use of animals in circuses and novelty acts. We look at the exotic pet trade. And we also have a very strong component which is aimed at helping wildlife in the wild. So we have quite a number of campaigns over the years dealing with issues pertaining to wildlife management, extraction from wildlife in the wild for various purposes. And we've also played a small but I think important role in some areas in different parts of the world, such as now we're funding aerial anti-poaching units in the lower Zambezi. So we've done things like that actually are focused more on wildlife in the wild as well. But most people know us as sort of the group in Canada that you would call if you had a concern about a zoo or aquarium or that kind of a situation.
So I'm guessing that you and I would probably agree that things are dire for wildlife in general. But can you talk about what is the scope of wildlife in captivity? Is that, in terms of populations, is that a problem to wildlife populations, or is this mainly just individual animals who are then suffering in captivity?
It's actually both. Certainly, if you look at zoos throughout the world, and the estimated number of zoos is about 10 to 12,000, with about 1,200 core zoos, meaning those that have sort of professional staff that have training or education in what they're doing. So you have about 10 to 12,000 zoos. You have additional untold thousands of other kinds of exhibits. So in terms of numbers of individuals that are suffering in these kinds of institutions, in these places, you're looking at probably in the low millions collectively. So it's certainly a problem for many of those animals that are incarcerated in those situations, but there is also another real concern about wildlife in the wild, because contrary to a lot of the propaganda that's been put out by the better-funded zoos, in which many members of the media haven't done any critical thinking about or asked hard questions about, and have just sort of promoted their message as is, there's also a real problem still with zoos taking animals from the wild. So you get not so much the mammals anymore, because predominantly they are being bred in captivity, but there are still some, like orphaned bear cubs, orphaned polar bear cubs, animals like that that are just grabbed up by zoos whenever they're available, and they're an easy disposal method for fish and wildlife agencies and others who end up having custody of these animals. But if you look at other kinds of animals, if you look at still many of the birds, despite the restrictions that were put on by international treaties, there are still many birds coming into captivity, and there are literally millions and millions and millions of reptiles, amphibians, and hundreds of millions of fish and invertebrates that are being extracted from intact wild environments for various forms of captivity. So you've got a double problem if you're the animals. If you're in the wild, you may face a threat of being removed from wherever you are and put into some form of captivity. I should have mentioned the pet trade, too. That's a huge problem. And if you're already in captivity, well, despite the propaganda put out there by the better-funded zoos, the life of most animals in captivity is pretty bleak. Most of them, you know, they've evolved to live in certain kinds of environments and to do certain things within a certain social context. context, et cetera, et cetera. And most of them are either severely restricted from engaging in those types of things, or they can't do them at all. And I've had an opportunity to look at all different forms of captivity, zoos, aquariums, reptile farms, elephant camps, you name it, all around the world. And I can tell you from firsthand experience that for most of these animals, life is pretty grim.
I want to ask you about that grimness in a moment. First, I want to mention a quote that I remember seeing by a anti-zoo activist. Gosh, this was 30 years ago. He was saying that he thought that the only creatures who should ever be put into zoos would be if at no time in the creature's life did it ever know that it was in captivity, by which he meant that the only creatures who would ever be acceptable in zoos would be basically a very small insect in a cage the size of a forest. And he was, of course, making a rhetorical point with that. But can you talk about the actual existence that... I'll tell another story real quick. I wrote a book on zoos called... Thought to Exist in the Wild, Awakening from the Nightmare of Zoos. And I began it, I had to go to a zoo before I could write the book, and I began it with an image that I'll never get out of my mind. There was a grizzly bear in a cage, or what they call a habitat, and the grizzly bear was taking three steps, dipping her head, turning to the left, taking two steps, dipping her head, three steps, dipping her head, two steps, dipping her head, and this was her life. And so can you talk about the existence of creatures in zoos? Just choose a few examples from, they can be mammals, they can be fish, they can be anybody.
Yeah, okay. I think that the problems that occur or are faced by animals in captivity, they sort of run the continuum from even the invertebrates right up to the biggest mammals. So I think a lot of the problems, although we didn't think so in the past, we know now, a lot of the problems are shared whether you're a fish or a reptile or an amphibian or a bird or a mammal or even an invertebrate, possibly like an octopus. So, you know, there's this commonality of issues amongst all these animals. And from what I've seen, you know, in all different places that I've been to, most of the animals live impoverished lives, and I mean impoverished in a physical sense, in that they cannot engage in normal movements like they would in the wild. So, for instance, a condor in a zoo, it's lucky if it can take two or three flaps of its wings, or an eagle or any other type of raptor, you know, in zoos. They're typically lucky if they can take even a few flaps of their wings. An elephant that would range over an area of 500 square kilometers, or what's that in the United States, 300 square miles or something like that, to about 5,500 square kilometers or more, you know, will be compressed into a very small space. The American Zoo and Aquarium Association standard is about the equivalent of 27 regular sized parking lot spaces. You know, that animal cannot move or engage in the movements or behaviors that it would do on a daily basis. And for in the case of elephants, up to 18 hours a day. So you've got a lot of animals that are extremely restricted in movement, and they suffer consequences of that, you know, debilitated health through loss of musculature, loss of cardiovascular fitness, circulatory problems, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there's a lot of those kinds of issues faced by all kinds of animals, and that's why you see so many problems in so many animals, including amongst a broad range of species, an epidemic of obesity in zoos, because animals are just sitting around with nothing to do because they don't have the space or environment in which to do the things that they're supposed to do. And then along with the physical issues, there's tremendous psychological issues, and they're often manifested in an obvious way that people can see. And the grizzly bear that you mentioned showing the stereotypic behaviors, and stereotypies are those meaningless repetitive movements that are divorced from their original stimulation. So they would be things like the elephant rocking back and forth or swinging its head side to side, or the polar bear or the grizzly bear pacing in a particular pattern and then doing a ritualized head turn at the end of that pattern and going back and repeating it. And for some animals, that can comprise 60, 70, 80% of their waking hours. So they're engaged in it all the time. And it's something that's problematic and never seen in the wild. There are other kinds of obvious behaviors like, you know, apes vomiting their food and then eating the vomit, vomiting it again, eating their excrement. There is all kinds of different things that you can look at, even in animals that we often thought were sort of biological robots in the past, like reptiles. We now know that they're not. And if you look at reptiles, you can see all kinds of problematic behaviors in zoos. Like one of them that many people probably encountered that they never even realized was a problem was a behavior called interaction with transparent boundaries. Many reptiles can't recognize plexiglass or glass boundaries. They cannot understand that they can't get through, so they make repeated attempts to try to get through, and they never learn that they can't, so this becomes ingrained, sort of like the mammalian or avian equivalent of a stereotypy. So you get lots of reptiles in zoos that are engaged in interaction of transparent boundaries, running up and down these boundaries, causing dermal abrasions. You know, if it's monitor lizards up against the glass, they can be, you know, wrecking their nails. There's all kinds of problems that can result. But I think one of the biggest problems that anybody can see in almost any zoo that 99.9% of people do not recognize as abnormal is lethargy. Animals doing nothing because they're stuck in these tiny little compressed environments where they can't do anything. And that is so abnormal. And I've gone to so many zoos where people don't recognize an animal doing nothing as being abnormal. And in fact, there's sort of a normalization process in some visitors. They go to the zoo and they seem to come away with this idea that a lot of animals are inactive. Like the elephants I mentioned, elephants are active up to 18 hours a day or more. They generally only sleep 4 hours a day. So they're engaged in their environment and in with their members of their family and extended family all those other hours. Yet you go to the zoo and you see them standing around, shuffling in a small elephant yard, and even the biggest exhibits in zoos in the United States for elephants are pretty darn tiny. You see them hardly moving at all, and that is a problem. You know, so many of these animals that should be active, doing things, climbing, running, finding mates, defending territories, foraging for food, or in the case of some animals, you know, many scientists believe they just want to go somewhere because they prefer to be there. It's just nicer to be there. Well, none of those things are available to most of these animals in captivity. And, you know, they end up sitting around doing nothing. So lethargy is a huge problem. But, you know, I would challenge anybody to go into almost any zoo in the world and not be able to find legions of instances of animals that are suffering in a physical sense and animals that are showing signs of psychological distress or suffering. I think you can look at almost any species from, you know, like I keep saying, from invertebrates to the larger mammals and find signs of discomfort, stress, and suffering. They're there if you know what to look for. Unfortunately, most casual zoo visitors don't know what to look for.
It seems to me also that as well as the simple confinement, that it would be absolutely maddening to be, I don't know, say an ungulate and then have constantly be smelling the cheetahs who are, you know, two cages over, or to be a fairly shy animal, and yet you have these, you know, strange hairless apes always looking at you. It seems that there would be tremendous, not only the confinement, but also the strange smells and everything else would be maddening.
Oh, absolutely. And there is science on that now. There are studies that show that just people looking at gorillas can be highly stressful to gorillas. There are studies that show the same with some macaques and with mangabees. There are even studies that show that animals that perceive being looked at as a sign of a potential predatory attack are stressed by people looking at them. And a good example is some of the lizards. They will often sit very still when they're being looked at, and that's a defensive mechanism. They're hoping a predator doesn't notice them, and if they move, certainly the predator would notice them, so they stay still as a defensive mechanism, and they watch until that threat goes away. But they perceive the predator looking at them as a threat. Well, if you've got a lizard in a tank and people are going by all day, well, presumably in a busy facility, that threat will never go away, so that animal will be in either a predicament of constant chronic stress. And just the way zoos are set up, there's not usually situations in which the viewing of the animals, the observation of the animals, is not unfettered. You know, they don't use ingenious ways of allowing people to see animals with no disturbance or invasiveness in the animal's life. They allow this unfettered viewing opportunity, and I think that shows very much that zoos are primarily places for people. They're not places for animal. But yes, the observation of animals itself can be severely problematic, and that's exactly why you see in specialist conservation breeding centers and in most sanctuaries, there's either very limited or no access for the public to view animals. And I think that's an important distinction when you're looking at animals in captivity and what might serve their interests in a sanctuary or retirement setting or a legitimate conservation setting versus just being on display in a zoo, that unfettered access, that observation, because I think it's bad. I think it would suck, sitting there, if you're an intelligent animal like a gorilla, and knowing and seeing all these people going by and shouting at you and doing the things that zoo visitors do.
That actually reminds me of something. When I was at the zoo that day, there was a child who was banging on the glass in front of the gorilla, and one of the gorillas picked up a pile of shit and walked over to the child and smeared the feces on the glass right in front of the child. And I thought it was extraordinary because all the people in the area, basically except me, started hooting with laughter. And I was thinking, don't you realize what that gorilla just said to you?
Yeah, I think a lot of those kinds of behaviors, there was, other animals that have done similar things, including other apes. Like there were chimps in a UK zoo that I visited one time that, because they were so bored, they would design ways to keep themselves amused. So they'd climb up high on the bars and they would call the visitors in with their hands, and when they were close enough, they tried to urinate on them. People thought that was funny. Maybe not if you're the one being urinated on, but to me, it's a bit of a call for help. You know, these animals are so bored, they're trying to do anything that they can to keep themselves occupied. Unfortunately, a lot of people just see these things as either being meaningless or being cute, or I've heard these types of animal behaviors characterized as, oh, they're just being naughty, or, those kinds of things. And I really think that they're signs of problems, most of the time.
I think it reminds me also of something that happens in maximum security prisons called gassing, where they'll take their feces, the prisoners will take their feces and throw them at the guards. And my point is that I think it also shows a desperation and a hatred. I mean, it feels to me like it's an expression of what they think about their captors.
Oh, I think for some animals that might be the case. And it's funny that you brought up that prison analogy, because I have a friend who operates a chimpanzee sanctuary in Quebec, and these are animals that have come from laboratory research. Some of them are HIV infected. And she likened their lives and their life at the sanctuary as being prison-like. And she said that when she was first learning how to deal with these chimps, she didn't watch nature shows or look at at what Zeus had done, she learned more about prisons to find out how the humans reacted in order to help her to better manage the chimpanzees that she had in her care. And I think it's very interesting, you know, that analogy, because I think it's apt for a broad range of species. But yeah, certainly we see similar kinds of behaviors in people in those same kinds of dire circumstances. And I think it shows that, hey, we're not any different than them. We're just, you know, a hairless ape.
So, okay, I'm going to ask this question, and don't I don't mean it. So don't, I'm asking this sort of as a softball. So who cares? I mean, why do we care if a python is distressed? I mean, what's the big deal? And I mean, who cares if some fish that should be able to live in a free-flowing river is put into a 10-gallon aquarium?
Well, that's a legitimate question, and the answer is that some people just don't care. But I think there are a multitude of reasons as to why other people do care. You know, for some, like for me, it's just something that was in me ever since I was a little kid. You know, I've always cared, and I always thought animals got a raw deal. For others, it's learning about the science. When they find out that, hey, there's been 1,500 papers on fish cognition and you know, intelligence and problem solving and maternal behaviors and, you know, all that kind of stuff, that it really informs their perspective and changes it. For other people, it can be an epiphany that's occurred at some point in their life where suddenly they just realize, hey, you know, these animals are getting a bad deal. I've encountered a lot of different people, and for some of them, you know, the reasons for their compassion and their action are very personal and emotional, and for others it's very analytical and clinical and academic. So I think there's a whole range of reasons. I think we have to always remember that there's going to be, you know, that 20% of the population that couldn't care less about animals and, you know, would exploit them for whatever dollars they could at every opportunity. But I think that most people at some level, although it may not be manifested in their behavior or their actions on a daily basis, I still think that most people have some level of empathy for animals, and you know, maybe it's not enough in a lot of people, but I think there is some level there, and we've got to exploit that as advocates for animals as best we can.
So we've talked a bit about zoos. Can you talk a little bit about the pet trade, and especially wild-caught creatures of one sort or another?
Yeah, it's a problem that doesn't have nearly the profile of zoo issues, and that's unfortunate because the numbers of individual animals involved are far in excess of those found in zoos. And that's not to try to delegitimize what's happening in animals in zoos, because, you know, they have miserable lives and need help too. But certainly, I think more attention should be focused on exotic pets, because a lot of people see the keeping of exotic pets as a relatively benign activity. They don't see why shouldn't, you know, so-and-so have the rosy boa or the iguana or the toke gecko or the scarlet macaw. They just don't see that there's anything wrong with it, and their experiences tend to be positive ones in which they see somebody who has this animal and, you know, they're petting it and they're saying they love it and they're, you know, enjoying its company, and the impression is that the animal is enjoying the person's company as well. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, as bad as the lives are of animals in zoos, I would say that probably in most cases, they're much, much worse for wild animals kept as pets. And the reasons for that, some of them are obvious, like the fact that if you take an animal into a home situation, if you're the average pet consumer, you're not going to be able to provide the space or the resources that a professional institution could. So, you know, let's take, for example, any of the big parrots, the cockatoos or macaws. Well, I think it's inconceivable that anybody could could possibly keep one of those birds or some of those birds in a home setting. You know, these are highly gregarious, extremely intelligent, wide-ranging birds. I remember watching an interview with a guy who studied macaws in Central America, and they asked him, in all honesty, you know, how big a cage would you need to really accommodate these birds so that their biological and behavioral needs were actually met? And he pondered it for a minute and said, I think probably about 50 square miles. So I think, you know, when you look at the exotic pet industry, you see animals that are compressed into microscopically small spaces compared to the spaces that they would inhabit in the wild, and even in many instances compared to the spaces that they may inhabit in other forms of captivity. But then you've also got, you know, the numbers. The numbers are incredible. 10 to 12 million reptiles in trade, in the pet trade, every year, with millions of them being extracted from intact wild habitats. And they're coming from Latin America, from Africa, and from Asia, and they're going into the three primary markets, which are the EU, Japan, now a bit China, and North America. But you've got millions of these creatures. So you can walk into pet stores here in Toronto or in Dallas or in Los Angeles and look at reptiles, and the same goes for amphibians, and the same goes for fish, and probably find many, many individuals who just a few short weeks ago were swimming around or walking around or burrowing in their natural environment before being taken. So you've got, you know, millions of these creatures that are being extracted from the wild. You've got the bulk of the consumers that don't have the capacity or the expertise to properly accommodate these animals. They, you know, typically in the case of, let's say, reptiles, the usual setup is a small aquarium, you know, which is bad to begin with because of the behavior I mentioned earlier, interaction with transparent boundaries. You've got a small aquarium with maybe some type of substrate and a hide area, a bowl of water, and, you know, maybe another feature for the animal to climb on or something. And then typically a heat lamp. So you've got one warm spot and one cold spot. Well, you know, that when you look at that kind of setup, and the same kinds of simplistic setups are, you know, advocated in the pet industry for birds and for amphibians and fish and many mammals too. When you look at that, it's really contrary to everything that these animals need. And if you look at, you know, their natural biology, their natural behavior, their typical lifestyle activities in the wild, and compare that to what they're experiencing in a tank or on a T-barred stand in the case of a bird, or on a leash in the case of a monkey that's in a house, you know, there is no comparison. These animals are in environments that are completely and totally contrary to what they should be in. And there's an alarming trend for some of these animals in that they are being kept in increasingly stark and clinical environments. And you see this with many reptiles, where you see reptile keepers keeping hundreds of lizards and snakes in Tupperware containers and in drawers and things like that. And everything about what they're providing is contrary to what these animals should have. All they're focused on is finance, convenience, and trying to satisfy the most basic biological survival needs of these animals, and nothing else. They don't recognize them as sentient, as having interests and motivations and behaviors, and you name it, and needing an expansive, complex environment with microclimates and with opportunities to make choices and all of that. So, you know, the whole pet trade thing, you've got these millions of animals, many of them bred in captivity, many of them coming from the wild, and, you know, all of them ending up in these just horrific circumstances, and typically they don't live very long. I think the estimate was 75% of all reptiles die within 24 months of getting to the consumer's home. Well, you can imagine the outrage if that were dogs. You know, if all the shelters in the United States adopted out dogs and 75% of them were all dead within 24 months, well, you know, that's not acceptable for some animals, yet it seems to be sort of par for the course for many animals in the exotic pet industry. So I think there's a whole range of problems. We could talk about other problems like the public health and safety issues pertaining to not only the physical threats posed by certain animals, but the disease threats, you know, the fact that many animals, including reptiles, birds, amphibians, and young ruminants that carry legions of potentially pathogenic organisms as a natural part of their flora and fauna. You know, they, you know, it's not anything unusual. There's so many issues. Whatever way you look at the pet trade, the exotic pet trade, whether it's from conservation, from animal welfare, or from public health and safety, it's a disaster and it should be stopped.
You know, I'm thinking on an ecological perspective of a line that, once again, I heard 25 or 30 years ago that makes so much sense, which is when someone captures an anole or any creature or a neon tetra, when they capture it in the wild and then put it in the pet trade, from an ecological perspective, they may as well just bash its brains out right then.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, they're removing animals that have a role to play in the ecosystems they inhabit. And, you know, the understanding of ecology generally is still at a very rudimentary phase. We don't know what a lot of the implications might be for, you know, changing this or changing that or removing this or removing that. Every time that you remove, an element of that ecology, I think you're going to face the potential of impairing the functioning of that ecology. That's something that a lot of people don't consider. All they look at is that mythical sustainable use nonsense and think that, well, you know, if the population's this high or that high, then, you know, maybe things will be okay. They tend to ignore everything else. A good example was the case of when the Georgia Aquarium was trying to import, and they had several partners, you know, SeaWorld and John G. Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, and I believe there's another. They were trying to import 18 wild-caught belugas from Russia, and they were trying to approach this in a very clinical way, saying, well, this won't have, you know, implications on the population and blah, blah, blah. But what they never looked at was, you know, these animals, just like elephants and just like many other species, may have individuals that sort of are the glue that bind the society together. And when you take them out, that society falls apart or becomes dysfunctional. Certainly you see that with elephants, you see that with rhinos, you see that with whales, you see that with other creatures. And, you know, a lot of times people just don't think through the whole scenario for that animal or for that species. They are impairing the functioning of that environment. They are impairing the functioning of that the animals that exist within that social context, and of course they're dooming the animals that are caught probably to a miserable life and an early death.
Here's a question that I've always wondered: when they catch, my understanding is that many of the fish for tropical fish trade are wild caught, and the ones who are wild caught, especially the small ones, how do they catch them? Do they catch them individually, or do they throw out nets and have bycatch that they kill? How does that actually work?
There's all kinds of methods, and I should just say that a great deal of the freshwater fish are bred in captivity. So a lot of the sort of typical 10 or 12 or 20 most popular species, a lot of those would be bred in captivity. But where the wild captures are particularly problematic are for saltwater species, particularly for coral reef species. So there's a whole variety of methods. There can be hand netting, there can be throw netting, there can be anesthetic drugs put into the water to debilitate the fish temporarily while they're collected. You know, most people have probably heard about the dynamite fishing of coral reefs, where they, you know, the blast impact stun the fish, they float to the surface, and then they're collected, and the ones that survive go into the aquarium trade. So there's a whole broad range of ways that people collect the fish, and certainly for other animals too. If you look at the collection of reptiles, you know, there are people that drive along roads on a sunny day, and the reptiles come out to take advantage of the pavement and heat to raise their temperature, and people come along and in some cases, will just walk along and pick those reptiles up and put them in the bags. Others will knock them out of trees with poles. And, you know, there's a whole variety of ways of capturing different kinds of animals, everything from hand catching to nets to traps.
So we have not talked about finances, and can you talk briefly about the money involved in both zoo/aquarium/entertainment and the exotic pet trades? Are those big businesses, small businesses? How much money is involved?
Well, certainly, if you look at zoos, and I mentioned the estimated number of zoos at 10 to 12,000 sort of traditional style zoos in the world, you're looking at in that community in the tens of billions of dollars annually. So, you know, it's you know, not as big as the computer business or, you know, maybe factory farming or things like that, but it certainly is substantial. It's not anything to sneer at. I think you'd be looking at probably a greater amount in the exotic pet trade. I've read estimates. I don't know if they're believable, but I've read estimates that the illegal trade in exotic pets is worth about $15 billion a year, and that they figure the legal trade might be similar. I think even if you didn't accept that amount and you downgraded it substantially, you're still looking at huge amounts of money that are being utilized by these both industries each year. And then if you look at, like in the zoo community, individual institutions, the amounts of money that they are involved in their operations is staggering. Here in Toronto, the Toronto Zoo's budget last year was $54 million. If you look at the San Diego Zoo and San Diego Wild Animal Park, I just read an article that estimated their annual operating budgets at around $200 million. So if you add up all of these zoos in North America and in other parts of the world, you're looking at staggering sums of money. You know, it's mind-boggling what they consume in terms of financial resources. And what's even more mind-boggling to me is how little they produce for that, other than entertainment for the masses.
Well, isn't that really the whole point? And, well, okay, I'm going to throw this out too. And like I said earlier, I wrote an entire book really debunking this, but I'm going to throw this out anyway. The argument that they make for zoos is that they educate people and that they are a very important educational tool to teach us about what giraffes and grizzly bears and Burmese pythons are like.
Yeah, well, there's two great mythologies about modern zoos, and that's their contribution to education and to conservation. And I think they are mythologies. I think they're being dismantled slowly but surely now. You see that manifested even in the academic zoo literature. In the case of education, that's largely nonsense. I don't think anybody that seriously looks at this accepts that, you know, casual visitors walking through a zoo viewing animals in TV clicker fashion for a few seconds at a time learns anything. At most, you're going to learn the size, shape, and color of the animal, but even then, that can be severely different than the animal normally is. And a good example is polar bears. You know, a lot of polar bears in captivity lose their fur. They lose their blubber layer. They lose their whole shape. They become very bell-shaped. They don't really look like wild polar bears. The same for cats. I've seen tigers in the wild, and I've seen a lot of tigers in zoos, and the ones in zoos do not look like the tigers in the wild. So even in terms of size, shape, and color, you can't learn much. The zoo community always likes to say, we're here, we're important educators of people. You know, we're conveying all this important information about conservation. But if you go to most zoos, you can see that that's completely false. You know, what you see typically are vague whimperings about endangered species in far-off places. You never see any real information. You see entertaining factoids and things that don't really matter. And in fact, there was one of the icons of the U.S. Zoo industry was once saying, well, you know, we got to do a better job at educating people, because sure, a kid might walk out knowing the length of an orangutan's left arm, but who the heck cares? Like, what difference does that make? You know, so I think zoos like to say they're educating, but using this factoid-based type of presentation of information doesn't work. I don't think, and we've looked for it for 20 years, there's no substantive body of empirical evidence supporting this idea that zoos actually educate anybody in the way they do. I think the evidence shows that, you know, if you walk into the zoo and you're an animal rights activist, that's going to be reinforced. If you walk into the zoo and you're a hunter that's very utilitarian in your approach to animals, well, that's going to be reinforced. Nobody's really being changed, and certainly there's almost zero evidence that anyone's behavior is being changed, and that's the important thing, you know, because even if zoos were educating people, there's no behavior change. So what's the point? You know, it just doesn't, to me, make any sense. It's entertainment. That's what it is.
And even if they were educational, that doesn't alter the fact that it's our education at the expense of incarcerating beings whose only sin was that they happened to be on the road when some jerk walked by.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think people don't weigh the cost to the animal. You know, there are better ways of learning about animals. You know, the whole zoo concept is predicated on menagerie-style format that originated in, I think, the Vienna Zoo in 1752 and spread from there. And, you know, I suppose way back then, hundreds of years ago, you might have made a case that in some way, shape, or form, it was educational. I don't really think it was, but I suppose you could make a better case than you could today. Because back then, you know, there were no opportunities like there are today to learn about animals. You know, there are all kinds of different ways of learning today that didn't exist back when the zoo concept began. And, you know, I think that the time has come to sort of look at that whole menagerie-style zoo concept and say, hey, that's got to be a thing of the past. It should be gone. And unfortunately, most of the major urban zoos in the world follow that format.
So I think you and I would probably agree that really the best way to learn about wild animals is to simply go out and say hello to them in the outside, where they can
leave. Absolutely. Absolutely. And There's something that's always bugged me. Zoos say that, you know, if you want to experience nature, come and visit our facility and you'll see nature. Of course, it's, you know, tiny fragments of nature completely divorced from their ecological context, but they still say, come and see nature. What they should be saying, if they were, you know, being honest about it, is, let's change the way that we think about nature. We don't need to come to the zoo. We don't need to go down the street to see the elephant or the zebu or the okapi or the marmoset in a zoo. We need to learn that everywhere around us there is fantastic nature. There's fantastic nature in the cracks on the sidewalk outside your house. There's fantastic nature flying overhead during migration period in any city. There's fantastic nature in local parks and streams. We have to learn that we have to appreciate not just animals that are incarcerated in zoos. We have to learn that there's nature everywhere that we should be appreciating and learning from. We don't need nature in a box.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I have two major questions. The second question is going to be, what do you want people to do in general? The first question is, okay, you and I would agree that zoos shouldn't exist and that the exotic pet trade shouldn't exist, but that doesn't alter the fact that right now there are literally tens of millions of creatures who have been kidnapped and put into untenable situations. And so, insofar as possible, what would you like, given that reality, what do you want to see happen to that grizzly bear I mentioned at the Detroit Zoo? What do you want to see happen to the beings who have already been taken out of nature? And then second, what do you want us to do on the larger scale?
I think the sad reality for many of these animals is that there is no salvation for them. But I think we have to look at them in a couple of ways. We have to look at them, one, as animals that we must try to help by improving their lives or by getting them out of the particularly dire circumstances that they're in. But I also think we have to recognize that, hey, we're not going to be able to help them all. There are just too many. There are millions of them. Even if we built, you know, 10 sanctuaries a day and did all these other things, the unfortunate reality is that a lot of these animals are going to not be in good circumstances until they die. But we have a responsibility to make sure that more don't follow them. You know, let's help the ones we can, but let's make sure that more creatures don't follow them and end up in those same situations. So what I always tell people is you have to find your place on the continuum of activism and always seek to improve, because that old saying that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good to do nothing is very true. And unfortunately, certainly in Canada, I expect it's the same in the United States, while there, you know, there are a lot of vocal people, we don't have nearly enough. We need advocates to not only increase in number, but we also need advocates out there, at least a segment of advocates who increase in their level of sophistication by learning more about the animals and learning more about how to affect change in their local communities. So I say to people, just make a decision to become active. Learn as much as you can, not only about the animals, but about the political processes that affect them, and then get to work talking and meeting with your elected officials and becoming politically active and more sophisticated in your approach and your understanding to dealing with animal problems. We don't have enough people. Like here in Canada, there's a lot of people that are involved in this, but very few who actually know anything about animals and very few who know anything about how to affect change. And on the broader level, I would say pretty much the same thing, that we just need more people with a higher level of sophistication. You know, there are a lot of issues out there. There are obviously one being discussed in the United States right now is the threat of terrorism, but there's, you know, massive environmental issues. There's all kinds of issues. You know, we can't let the fact that there are other issues stop us from becoming the best advocates that we can for animals. So we just need more people with a higher level of sophistication, and I think things can change. Now, a lot of people often say, well, you know, change is too slow or change doesn't happen. But I can say certainly in our experience here in Canada, we're a very, very small organization with a small budget. But we've got a tremendous track record of policy changes, of litigations, of changing corporate behaviors. We've closed down about 35 or 40 zoos over the years. So I point to ourselves and say, look, if we can do it, then so can and other people and other organizations. You just have to have a lot of drive, passion, and increase your level of sophistication and understanding of how things work.
Well, I think that would be a wonderful place to end, but I still want to ask you one more thing, which is,
okay,
when you said about the zoos closing down,
and yes,
let's say that Canada made you the emperor of all things zoo, and what would you, what hope, I mean, I know we can't, you couldn't save them all, but like you mentioned, the friend of yours who has the sanctuary for the chimpanzees who were in research, what can be done for at least some of them? Like, are there places where elephants can be put into a better situation, where bears can, where Burmese pythons can? Is there hope for any of them?
I think there's always hope, because if in a perfect world all the zoos were gone or were phased out, then I expect that at least some of the time, energy, and resources that were put into the zoo industry by people who genuinely do like wildlife and like animals would find another venue. And that venue could be in the creation of sanctuaries or in reserves or other types of situations where animals can have better lives. I think that's certainly a possibility, and we're seeing a massive growth in it. You know, we have a huge growth in the number of sanctuaries for farmed animals. There's a growth in the number of elephant sanctuaries. A colleague of mine just started one in Brazil. There's another one starting in the United States. They're talking about them in Europe. So we are seeing this. There may be places for some of these animals, and certainly if that's where the attention went, then you know that whole area could just explode and be a huge benefit for many animals. I think there's always hope. It's just, you know, changing things from what they are now to something different. You know, it's always a struggle, but there's always hope.
Well, thank you so much for all that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Rob Laidlaw. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.